You are listening to the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Hello, listeners. Welcome, one and all. Marty here, and I am back in the saddle for another round of Math Magic. Glad you could join me. A few announcements here before we jump into the interview this evening. I was recently a guest on a few podcasts that are available now for download. This last Sunday, I did the Richard Serrett Show called The Conspiracy Show, and that is found on iTunes as well as on richardserrett.com with Serrett spelled S-Y-R-E-T-T. It was an hour conversation, and I tried to cram in as much info as possible, so check that out if you are feeling saucy and sassy. I was also a guest on the SyncBook Radio Zone 42 Minutes with Douglas Bowles, and our conversation was centered around Manly Palmer Hall's The Secret Teachings of All Ages, a fantastic compendium of esoteric knowledge, and we ended up focusing on Pythagoras and his life and work. Check those shows out if you get a chance. I also want to let everyone know that I'm not sure if I will have a podcast next week. This next weekend is my birthday weekend, and I'm getting a little long in the tooth, as a fellow tends to say, and I'm looking at being out of town, so I won't be able to prep for the show. But fret not, lots of great guests are on the roster, so keep your dial tuned to the SyncBook Radio. Thanks to everyone who signed up for the beta testing on the SyncBook site. My deepest appreciation. Please don't forget to throw a donation our way if you can afford it. Our IT guy behind the scenes, Guillaume, as well as Alan Abadesa Green, they've been hard at work at reworking the site to make it more efficient and user friendly and the like. And so any spare change you can throw our way is certainly appreciated. Alrighty, folks, let's do this. Our guest tonight is author of The Giza Template, Edward Nightingale, and the musical guest is the singer-songwriter Michael Conley. This show is brought to you by the SyncBook Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts. 42 Minutes, Always Record, Astro Music, Pentimental, and Synchronize. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, and SyncBook events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and please consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support. Our guest tonight is Edward Nightingale. Edward Nightingale is a master woodworker, musician, author, and researcher who has been researching the pyramids and Great Sphinx of Giza since 1997. Edward has presented his research at the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge, and he recently spoke at the 2014 Paradigm Symposium. His book, The Giza Template, Temple Grawl, Earth Measure, reveals that Giza was designed as a repository, encoding high scientific knowledge while tracking the trajectory of the solar system, mapping out the precessional ages. He takes the reader step by step, precisely recreating the Giza complex in its entirety, challenging academia and skeptics to recreate the template at Giza for themselves. Emphasizing that his research is not theoretical, he presents a geometric, mathematical model of Giza that is a real game changer. In the words of John Anthony West, the Giza template is the architectural Rosetta Stone. So without further ado, let's get pious with Edward Nightingale. Mr. Nightingale, welcome to the show. Thanks for making the time this evening to speak with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Marty. Appreciate you having me on.
So yeah, it's pretty auspicious that you ended up being the guest for the 22nd episode of this show with, the number 22 is a number steeped within number philosophy and symbolism. 22 cards of the tarot deck, of course, 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and least we not forget, 22 divided by 7 produces one of the most often used approximations of pi, and we can actually find this approximation of pi in the Great Pyramid of Giza, which is something that you cover in your book. So we got a lot to discuss here, and there's you know, and really any aspect of this work could take us down a path which would lead to, you know, 100 other paths. So, and I think the hardest thing about discussing these subjects, you know, over the air, the subjects like sacred geometry, metrology, mathematics, is the infinite places and directions we can take the work. But, you know, we'll try to stay on course here and do the best we can. So I know that that's can sometimes be difficult. So
yeah, sounds good.
So I got wind of your work through Laird Scranton.
Yes.
Whose work I've admired for quite some time now. And Laird contributed some perspectives for this book as well. How did you end up meeting him and collaborating with him and that sort of thing?
Well, I met Laird through John Anthony West. I was friends with John since 97 when I went over to Egypt with him. And I met Laird through John.
Okay. What was that experience like with John? How, did you spend a week? Because he does like week tours, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think it was 2 weeks we went over, and it was life changing, really. I mean, this is what really propelled me, you know, on this whole path here is that trip with him.
How long have you been investigating stuff before you went over there? Where, I mean, was this a core interest for you, like Egyptology and the mysteries of the pyramids and this sort of thing, or?
Well, I had been interested, you know, pretty early in my youth, probably around the time of the Chariots of the Gods with Eric Van Doniken. I started getting interested in that type of thing. And, you know, the pyramids always intrigued me just from the a building aspect. You know, as an architect, woodworker, designer, I can kind of relate to shapes. And they always really intrigued me. And I had an idea before I went with John, that it was a complex, designed as a complex. And I had an idea of where that center might be. If they were laying out a complex, you would have to start with one point and take all measure from that point. And when I went there, I actually found what I thought was the point. And 18 years or so later, I found, you know, that was in fact the case.
So you've been working on this for 18 years, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Like this particular aspect of the Giza Plateau, huh?
Yes, I was trying to, you know, figure out what the designers were doing there, why they built this. And I had an idea, and it was certainly not an original idea, that it was built as a repository and that they were using the geometry to, you know, encode information or knowledge. And that's why there are really no hieroglyphs or any kind of markings or carvings on the plateau.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, like what you put forward in the book is a reconstruction or it's a reverse engineering, as you said, of the Giza template. And you've laid out some parameters for like constructing the template itself, like certain things that you kind of anchored to. Can you discuss these a little bit so the listeners can get an understanding of the sort of methodology or, you know, logic you use to place the whole thing together?
Okay, well, like you said, I did start by reverse engineering it, and that's simply measuring what is existing, going in and trying to accurately measure what was built and seeing if there was some kind of a unified plan. Were there, did the numbers make sense why they placed these structures where they placed them? And after, when I went over there and I found what I thought to be the center point of the pyramid complex, which is at the beginning of the Sphinx Causeway that runs on a slight angle, it's about 350 so feet or so in front of the pyramid of Khefer, the center pyramid. That I had in my mind's eye was the center of the circle, so I started using circles and putting a compass at that point. And eventually I realized that the circle had a diameter of 9 units that were the base length of the center pyramid. And from that, it kind of developed from there. I realized that a lot of ancient cultures used a circle with a diameter of 9 they used a square of 8 of those units to calculate the area of a circle. And it's a very simple formula. And it was from that I realized that that's what they had used for the template or the survey plat for the complex. And once I had that figured in, things started to fall into place.
Okay, I want to get into the 8 and 9 and the circle and the square here just a little bit. But what drew you to find that particular point as the center of the circle?
Well, to me, it just looked like a balanced point within the center. And again, it was at the end of the causeway that runs from the front of Khafra east. It's on about a 13.5 degree angle off due east, and it runs down to the Sphinx. And that, to me, kind of looked like the hand of a clock. Now, I know there's other causeways with the other pyramids as well, but that center one just seemed to me to be like the hand of a clock. And ironically, that's exactly what it turned out to be.
So when you were traveling with John, did you do any surveying at all yourself there, or were you just getting like a general sense overview of the complex?
Right, I was just getting a general overview of the complex. I went there, like I said, with my mind focused on at one point. And when I went to that point, I found there was a hole, about a 3-inch or so hole, bored right in the bedrock that seemed to me to be approximately the point I was looking for. Now, whether that is precisely it now, I couldn't really tell you. I'd have to go back over and survey or look at that point again, but I'd like to get back over there and do that because I think that was the point. And I did record. I had a video recorder with me, and I actually recorded where I thought that point was back then. And but the problem I had run into was I was working off of survey maps or surveys from William Flinders Petrie and Cole, another survey that was done there. And the measurements that they had didn't quite jive with what I was finding in a logical mathematical model, if you want to put it that way. And it wasn't really until I purchased a QuickBird satellite view of Giza that I was able to really figure out what was going on.
And this you say in the book that this satellite image that you purchased actually is pretty damn accurate, correct?
Yes, correct. And I have in the book there, I have the quotes from the people at Satellite Imaging as well as another expert in the field. And I've worked with some local surveyors and ran it past them, and they all agree that the accuracy is there. And therein lies the problem, because there was such a large discrepancy between the Petrie survey and the satellite image. I've concluded that the Petrie data that was given not correctly, if you want to put it kindly. Mm-hmm. And the reasons that I give for that is that we're trying to keep some of this information from the general public, because with those measurements that the discrepancies were, that kept the puzzle from being put together properly.
You're bringing up a good point. I don't necessarily want to go down this road too much, but it seems like there's an overarching theme with modern Egyptology that a lot of this, the true information surrounding Egypt's past, surveys, like you said, things like that, seem to be hidden or abused, that sort of thing. Why do you see that is? I mean, would you agree with that? And if so, why would you, why is that?
Well, I definitely agree with that. And after a lot of research, I've, come to the conclusions that the reason it was hidden is because there's knowledge hidden there, encoded there, that was put there, and there's people that don't want that to be generally known in the public. Okay. Plain and simple.
Yeah. So let's talk about how modern Egyptology actually like perceives this entire complex or structure. I mean, it's not incorrect to say that basically, as we were saying, there's a general theme running through modern archaeology that the Giza monuments that there is really no cohesive design or underpinning the entire complex, right? I mean, there's the kind of the idea that this was kind of just thrown together over several years by megalomaniacal pharaohs, kind of idea, right?
Yes, and that was really insulting my intelligence, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, you see this entire complex as a design, as if these were blueprints that were passed on, you know, through many generations or whatever, through many different pharaohs coordinating this sort of massive undertaking, right? This enormous building project.
Absolutely. Absolutely correct.
Okay. So what ultimately the question that I always run into, or people will ask me when I, you know, talk about a lot of this stuff, is that, you know, guys like yourself, you know, some of the work that like Scott Onstad has done, of course, what Randall Carlson's done, these guys, when we look at this and we can extract all this mathematics and we can extract the geometry as you're doing, a lot of times the question comes up like, well, so what, you know, so what if they encoded all of this stuff? What does it mean? I mean, has anybody ever asked you that? And like, what's your take on that?
Yes. Yeah. I've been asked that quite a bit. And honestly, this next book that's coming out will really be the clincher for all this. The first book is if you want to call it, that would be your Batman decoder ring. Mm-hmm. That would give you all the information that you would need, the Earth measure, the whole measuring system's there, encoded and done beautifully. And in order to get into the stellar alignments and the celestial alignments with the Sphinx, I had to set this up with this first book that really lays out the groundwork. And it's from that point, once you get through this first book, that the next book will develop from the view from the Sphinx, essentially recording the sky and the movements of the stars and the asterisms, all the asterisms that are there in the Western asterisms or constellations. They all were not just put there willy-nilly. They're geometrically positioned within the coordinates at very specific times. And what I've discovered is how they use this to put together the calendar systems. And by calendar systems, I mean, I'm talking about the Hebrew calendar, I'm talking about the Gregorian calendar, and the Mayan calendar. They all perfectly can be reconciled from one date, and that date was the 2012 date, December 21st, 2012. And that was the galactic alignment, which is, you know, the largest alignment that you could really line something up with. And it's completely logical that they use these that date as an end of the calendar, at an end and a new beginning of this new cycle.
Yeah, you know, I had John Major Jenkins on, and we were talking about this because of his, I mean, astounding work that he did with reconstructing the Mayan cosmology and that sort of thing. And the thing that I always said was that 2012 was something important. There was something important about that whole date, and it wasn't just media hype and hoopla and that sort of thing. And so with what you're doing is kind of merging all these different cultures and saying that, yes, they're all pointing to this position, yes, this alignment. What is so important about this alignment besides the fact that it only occurs every whatever how many years?
Yeah, well, the alignment, I guess, is what's recorded in the calendar, this last calendar, is 1/5 of the cycle of a 25,920 year cycle of the precession. The beginning date of 3114 BC with the Mayan calendar is recording the 5,127 years of this cycle, which is the fifth of this age. Now, if you look, there's a climate changes or whatever you want to call it that are dated to that time, about 5,200 years ago. So we can see during this cycle, in a procession that there are times where there are changes, catastrophic or whatever you want to call it. And I think that that's exactly what they were pointing to, recording the cycle of the procession.
So basically, this is, as you were saying earlier, it's a repository of knowledge. One of those pieces of knowledge being that these are grand markers for cycles of catastrophe as well as cycles of birth and renewal, right?
Yes. And I want to emphasize that too. This doesn't all have to be a bad thing, because in fact, I haven't actually found anything that says something bad is going to happen. But then again, when you look at these dates, as we look back, like with the work of Randall Carlson, these dates usually have associated with them some kind of climate change or, to put it mildly, I guess, maybe catastrophic changes, whatever.
Mm-hmm. So can we step back here a little bit and discuss the numbers 8 and 9? And can we talk about the circle and square a little bit? Can you flesh some of this idea out for the listeners?
Sure. The 8 and the 9 is relevant because if you take a circle with a diameter of 9 units and you want to approximate the area, if you take 8 of those units and make a square, that area of that 8 by 8 square approximates the area of a circle with a 9-unit diameter. And ancient cultures use this to lay out their towns, or so that's the basics of that. Now, what I did and what I discovered after that point, I found that I asked myself, well, big deal, they got a circle and a square here in this template. Now, when I put that circle and square over and overlaid it with Giza, I realized that there were very significant points of alignment within that square, that 8 by 8 square. So I said, okay, well, what are they showing me here? A big deal, 8 by 8 square and a circle. So what? So I figured, well, there must be another step to this. So the next step would be to add numbers to that grid and make a coordinate system out of it, and that would be a way of putting numbers in coordinates in a coordinate system, which is the basis of analytical geometry. And when I did that, I looked through history, and as a musician, I was aware of the Pythagorean theorem, and I had read one time when I was looking into this about Plato giving his description of how God had created the universe by using 2 sets of numbers, a doubling sequence and a tripling sequence. And he went on to explain how he did this. And I used those numbers and applied them to the 8 by 8 square. And then I realized at that point that is where they came up with the whole measuring system, the musical scale. It's all right in this 8 by 8 square. And from those numbers and coordinates, I was able to actually very simply determine the lengths of the base lengths of the pyramids and the placement. And it kind of fell in,
Yeah, you lay it out very clearly in the book, because and I think what the listeners should know too is that this is not some arbitrary set of numbers, that the numbers that you're using are, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe Plato was the one that supposedly put the numbers to the Tetractus, these particular group of numbers, and what you've done is take the angles, the slopes of the Tetractus and put them onto essentially the chessboard, which is an 8x8 grid, correct?
Correct, yes.
So
you got it.
So, and the things that, and you lay this out, this whole section of the book, I had to stop and get my notebook out, and it was just, there's just so many amazing correlations that you've drawn here. Let's talk about Can we talk about the music scale that you get going diagonal from this? So you start out with the numbers of the Tetractus, you lay them across the board here, and then you can actually get the music scale, which gives us numbers like important numbers like 864. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, sure. If you put the numbers, the doubling system down the side, the tripling across the top on our 8x8 square, and if we draw a diagonal from corner to corner, that bottom number, as we're double going down the 8x8 square, we would end up with 256 at the bottom left corner of our square. And if we drew an angle diagonally, we would be connecting on 45 degrees or connecting intersection coordinates going up the scale. And within that is really a musical scale of what's called fifth intervals, like the fifth tone in a major scale going up the major scale. You would, at each step up the angle, you would have a fifth interval. So I realized there was a music scale right there, and you know, the more I get working with it and then dividing that, each one of those intervals then again into seven intervals, is where I discovered the actual root of the measuring system. Mm-hmm. And that would be between the notes of 288 and 432 on the scale.
And you discuss how the mean or the balance between that would be is 144, right?
Correct. Exactly. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And of course, 144. We could talk about that for the next 2 hours.
Yes, we could. There's so much. It was very hard. Actually, this was a very difficult book to write and try to put in everything. I mean, that is not even everything I've got. There's so much more. I just figured that, you know. You know, we could go on forever there with these numbers, but yeah, it's really an amazing, amazing thing that people really need to look at. And
yeah, you know, it's really interesting because you're using these sort of fundamentals that we find within, you know, Egyptian mathematics, Greek mathematics, core numbers that we find in sacred geometrical canon, and the one that you have pointed out here that just floored me, man, was just. So you have on the top section, you have the 139, 27, 81, etc. Anybody that knows the Tetractus can find this or, you know, purchase your book and check this out. And then the one side, you have 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. So you have the doubling pattern and the tripling pattern that's inherent in the Tetractus, as you were saying. And first off, the doubling and tripling is the numbers 2 and 3. And this gets right to the heart of ad quadratum and ad triangulum, which is the, you know, and so here you, and of course, what did you do? You drew a diagonal right through this square to find this, which is exactly what you do in ad quadratum. So that alone right there is pretty, pretty astounding. The one thing that just floored me was that this is on page 20 of your book here, is that when you actually create the 3-4-5 Pythagorean triangle using this grid that you set up, it hits 864, and 864 is of course a number that we can attribute to the sun. Sun has 864,000 miles, 86,400 seconds in a day. But the way that you get this is the numbers 32 and 27. And in English gematria, Jesus equals 27, Christ equals 32. So right on that square. And then English English alphabet, English equals 32 and alphabet equals 27. So we find these two very important numbers within our English alphabet in Jesus Christ, pointing to 864, and you have this laid out just beautifully right in your book, and I just found that just remarkable. So
yeah, there's things that just absolutely have floored me, and I got to tell you, this has been very humbling for me. I'm just a woodworker with an interest in this stuff, and when I found this, it was, you know, it just floored me too, I got to tell you, and it's still blows me away. I've uncovered a treasure here, you know. I mean, there's people that do know about this, not necessarily in the public, but you know, it is absolutely stunning. And you know, I don't know what else to say. It's been a humbling experience.
You know, I want to stay on course here, but I want to ask you a question. You know, as a musician yourself, like, and as you know, I'm a musician as well. Like, how has that affected your investigative process?
Well, really helped a lot. Just understanding music and music theorem, of course, that within that grid right there, that is the Hertz scale. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what that is. It's the electromagnetic scale. If you could keep going with that, you would go right up into the, light and et cetera. You can see it when you got it laid out there. You see where the 432 doubled is the speed of light. And if you were to double, or not double, square this 432, you get 186,624, mm-hmm. which is very closely approximates the speed of light. And the interesting thing to that is at 1 hertz, at our 1 on the corner of our 8x8 square, that would be a C note at 1 hertz. And the wavelength for C note 1 hertz is 186,636 miles, I think. So there's the relationship of the wavelength to the speed of light. It's all right there.
This is something that I always find so interesting, is that, you know, we can see this number 432. That's really important. We see right now we're tuned to A440. This is something that a lot of people bring up, and you bring it up in the book, that we should really be tuned to 432, because the Hertz using this scale harmonizes with the rest of the numbers that you have laid forth here, right?
Correct. I totally agree with that, too. I do not believe that we should be tuning to the 440 hertz. I think we should be tuned to 432. That's more in a natural, the natural frequency, receptive to humans, and all other measure as well. As you can see clearly, that's where all the measure comes from, directly related to 432.
When, you know, and we look at 432, this is going back to, you know, when we look at 432 squared, 432 times 432 is what is 186,624, something like that.
Correct.
And the speed of light has been measured at 186,000, roughly, 324 or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So we have this, the number of speed of the speed of light in miles per second, directly just found by simply squaring a single number that we find peppered all throughout sacred geometrical canon. This is something that I always want to get to. Like, why do you think that there's such a disconnect with modern mathematicians or Egyptologists or whatever when we look at something like that and blow it off, because there isn't an exactitude there? You know, we're talking about rough numbers, if you know what I'm asking.
Well, what I found, and this will take us right back to the musician part. Are you aware of the Pythagorean comma?
Yeah, it's after, 12 scales or something like that? You have to kind of tune down a little bit. Is that it?
Right. Well, what it is if you take, it's 7 octaves, and if you go up 7 octaves or you go up 12 fifth intervals, yes, those two notes are very close to the same note. But it's just the fifth intervals are just a little bit sharp. When we listen to that, those two notes, they would sound out of tune. They would not quite be right. So in order to make that sound right, we would have to adjust that that fifth interval, which the value of that fifth interval multiplying up our little scale there is multiplying by 1.5. That's a perfect fifth interval. But in the Pythagorean comma, you would have to adjust that down to about 1.498 something. I forget exactly off the top of my head. But then those two notes would sound in tune. Okay? Well, the same thing is going on with the speed of light. Okay? In our little chart there, we can come up with 186,624 as a very close approximate number for the speed of light. But what's really incredible that I discovered here was that using the fraction of 441 over 440, with that fraction, we can get to the precise speed of light. Now, the interesting thing about the 440 and the 441, those are in cubit lengths, the length of the base length of the Great Pyramid. It's 440 root or royal cubits in length, and it is also 441 root cubits in length. Same base length, just two units of measure. So right in the base length of the 440 royal cubits or 441 root cubits is the key to adjusting the speed of light to its proper speed measured today. And actually that speed comes a little closer to what we witness actually in the atmosphere of Earth. It's closer than what the scientists put as the speed of light in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. It's 27 miles an hour closer to the speed that we actually perceive it in the Earth's atmosphere. So the 441 and the 440 actually correct that speed that is on our chart there to the correct speed, just like the tuning of the Pythagorean comma adjusts the sound slightly.
Do you feel that the Egyptians, by leaving this, you know, these monuments, this entire complex, do you feel like that they were basically kind of encapsulating all of the knowledge that they had at whatever point in history it was for future generations, that so we could go measure this thing and therefore come up with all of these mathematics and the geometry and things like that? It seems like to me that what they were doing was marking the at some point in time, as you were saying, that this was the grandest and the most knowledgeable that human beings could ever get to, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, so I think that's right, and that's exactly what they did. They were encoding all this knowledge, I would assume, that every bit of knowledge that they had at the time, and put that there for us. And for good reason. We can see in these cycles of catastrophe that things can change in a hurry. And, you know, if you want to preserve the human race, you want to try to build on this knowledge and keep it and preserve it, just like they would do a seed vault. You know, they're doing a vault of knowledge of the measure and science. There's this... That little chart there is an amazing tool and a key to science. Nikola Tesla knew quite well what that was all about. And when he says he has a quote somewhere about the threes, sixes, and nines being the key to understanding the universe, he's exactly right. And if you do a little bit of summing on that chart there, you'll have a pretty big surprise when you talk about threes, sixes, and nines.
Yeah, it for sure. You know, you're bringing up a really great point, because as I'm going through your book, I'm reading all this stuff, I'm taking notes and whatnot, and I realize that I'm not doing any sort of advanced math whatsoever. This is all basic, just arithmetic.
Yes.
And it really, and as you were speaking of Nikola Tesla, I just came across this quote the other day. It says, "Today's scientists have substituted mathematics for experiments, and they wander off through equation after equation, and eventually build a structure which has no relation to reality." And really, what we see going on with the modern theory in physics and math and things like that is there's this almost like overthinking of it, like convoluting basic, mathematical principles, making things almost too difficult. And here we have, you're using essentially a chessboard. And of course, how old is the chessboard?
Yeah.
Prehistory. We see it all over Freemasonic halls and things like that. And yet the things that you can extract from it are, as we're talking here, pretty damn remarkable.
Yeah.
So to me, what all of this points to is that there's the way to this advanced knowledge is actually through simplicity. It's not through complexity. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely agree with that. And that's a great quote from Nikola Tesla, because that is exactly the case. We are just being inundated with a lot of nonsense. And if we could just cut to the chase, and this is stuff, you could be learning this stuff in middle school easily.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. What, so this is a question I think I asked Laird this as well, but you know, where, how do you think that they obtained this information?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one I'm certainly open to. You know, I don't like to really box myself in on anything, but the one example I've heard of in Egypt that says anything about the pyramids is I think it's in Edfu. There is an inscription that says, not quoting this precisely here, but it says something like, the plans for the temple came down from the heavens in the days of Imhotep. So, you know, I don't know whether they, you know, we can literally, you know, they literally came down from the sky, or these were just advanced civilizations that, you know, were affected from these catastrophic events. You know, the 10,500 BC event, the end of the Ice Age, and I guess there's several others there as well. But, yeah, you know, it's a good question. And I think, you know, if the more that this is understood, this template here, I think that there's going to be so many pieces of the puzzle coming together. Because, believe me, other researchers need to look at this. They are going off and finding very good pieces of the puzzle, and they could add to this, and this would assist them in understanding their research too. And I think those answers are there. I think that, you know, there is, you know, some more to be discovered at Giza. I'm quite certain of that, just on some of the geometric points that I found within the template that I don't really go too much into in the book. This next book has got quite a bit more regarding some of the possibilities for the underground, if you want to call it the Hall of Records or whatever you want to call it. But I'm sure, along with the what we can see above ground, that there are more things underground. And I believe that we'll be able to answer this precisely, you know, through discovered information. And I think that this work that I've put forth here is, you know, is key to understanding that.
One thing I wanted to ask you is that you attended the you gave a speech at the Conference of Procession and Ancient Knowledge, right? The CPAC conference, Walter Cruttenden, right?
Yes.
One of the things that he puts forward is that procession is actually clocked at roughly what 24,000 years or something like that, where the more often than not, I have found within my own investigation of the math itself, the 25,920 and divisors of that number. And that seems to be what you're pointing to as well. What's your take on the discrepancy of the 24,000 years, roughly 26,000 years?
Well, you know, I know Walter does have the 24,000 year idea there, and he gets that from, there's a Hindu philosopher from the late 1800s.
Sri Yukteswar.
You got it. That's it.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. And I think that's where he gets that from. And I'm not really sure about that with Walter. Matter of fact, I'd like to talk a little bit about procession here, because what I've discovered in this next step, actually, they recorded at Giza, they recorded the processional movement. And it's not from a wobbling earth.
Sure.
That's
the standard academia story there that the Earth is wobbling, and I really don't see any evidence for that at all. They can't measure that wobble within our own solar system. They can't measure that wobble against the sun or other planets. So I think that they need to just throw that out the window, because that's just not the case. Well, what I have found in this next book that I'll be publishing, and I put forth precisely what I found there, and it's really coming from a spiral movement away from the sword in Orion's belt, that our solar system was birthed from that point in it'd be M42, actually, in the Great Orion Nebula. And they also, in what they left at Giza, show that the Pleiades and the star Sirius both came from that same place as well, and that the three, our solar system, the Pleiades, and Sirius, are moving in a spiral motion away from the sword in Orion's nebula. And that spiral motion is what we're seeing as precession, as this wobble. It's not a wobble. It's our view of this spiral movement of our solar system moving away from this point in Orion's sword, the Great Orion Nebula. And it's very precise, too. It's this. I know this sounds like, what's this guy talking about? But I've got very precise information here that it's really hard to argue with, that that's in fact what the Egyptians were pointing to. And it reconciles all these calendars perfectly with alignments, and the major alignments coming from the Orion. Now also too, just to give you a quick the Orion correlation theory of Robert Bouval, is that is the one part of it. The other part of it is the Sphinx. Now the Sphinx is Leo, as a representative of Leo, the constellation, is showing the movement of the zodiac, the zodiac constellations, using the lion. That shows us the view of our precession, mm-hmm. which we see this circular movement. But then what the three belt stars, or the three pyramids indexed on the belt stars of Orion, then show is the cause of that view. And that cause of the view is from this spiral that emanates from that. And we can literally see that spiral in Barnard's loop.
Sure, and the Dogon talk about Barnard's loop as
exactly,
well. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. This all fits into the Dogon discussion and all of it. I mean, it really amazes me, and it excites me that I've come across this and want to share it. I kind of have felt like a boy who cried wolf with this whole thing. Everybody, there's been thousands of theories put forth with the Giza plateau, and I'm standing there just a little woodworking guy saying, oh, look what I found here, look what I found, and nobody seems to be listening, yeah. And but this next part we're going to be reconciling the calendars precisely with alignments that are anyone, it's as simple as the rest of this first book. All you need to do is sit in front of the Sphinx and watch the sky. And the key of that is the end date, or I shouldn't say the end beginning date of December 21st, 2012 at 12 hours, 20 minutes, 21 minutes and 12 seconds. So it was a binary code that they used for the Gregorian calendar for the end. of ones and twos.
Right down
to the minutes and seconds. And if you go on like a Stellarium or whatever star program you happen to have, and just look at the coordinates, I got that. I think I got that in the book. Or just go into coordinates on Google Earth or whatever. Go right between the paws of the Sphinx, and look at the sky at December 21st, 2012, at 12 hours, 21 minutes, and 12 seconds, and see what you see.
With all of these cultures seeming to point to time, right? I mean, basically, as you're saying, that the whole Giza Plateau in one way is a repository of knowledge. It's a marker of time. There's countless cultures that have clocked great spans of time, whether that's the Greeks or the Hindus. What is your take on why is this so important, besides the fact of, you know, cycles of catastrophe or birth and rebirth? Because most people in their lives are not going to experience those things. Like, what is so important about, you know, the mapping of time?
Well, again, I think it's really directly related to that. If we want, you know, this civilization or humanity to survive, we need to understand these cycles. And yes, they are much longer than a human lifetime, but, you know, therefore, even more important that we put this down. And then not only put it down in form of the architectural structures at Giza, but also within a verbal tradition that's implanted and encoded within stories that can get passed down, you know, verbally as well. And we can see that's where Laird really helped me out a lot on the book, and he added his linguistics to it, and it's all there. It's not just the architectural structures, it is the verbal tradition as well. And, you know, if we were to not understand this, and you know, this shit hit the fan, and you would lose all that knowledge, you would be back to square one, and take a long time to really come back from that. Where at least if the knowledge is there, and there are initiates or priests or whatever that have that knowledge and can pass it down, it's very important for humanity.
You know, it's funny that you bring up the phrase back to square one. Because when you think about it, if a square has a side of one, that means the diagonal is a square root of two, and that gets you right back to what you're talking about, which I think is just, it's kind of funny. So,
all right.
When we look at, I want to get your take on this, because this is something that I've been really like deeply considering about that sort of time. That's, you know, when we look out in the universe, when we look at the Earth, we look at the sun, everything is moving and growing and pulsating and spinning, and but there seems to be a grand tempo. But the tempo seems to be fixed, if you will. Like when the ancient people were mapping these great spans of time, whether that great span of time is the cycle of the Earth in the 365 days or a 25,920 year period, it seems like these cycles are fixed in time. That they're grand wheels within a great clock, and that they're never going to change. They're never going to move. That's what it seems like to me. And if we have these ancient structures, with Robert Schock talking about the Sphinx being possibly 10,000, 20,000 years old, it seems like the mapping this would that's almost what they're indicating, is that yes, when we map these cycles of time, we're mapping cycles of time that are going to be consistent for a very long time, at least, if not infinitely. I mean, what do you know what I'm trying to get to, and what is your take on that? And
yeah,
I'm bringing this up because there's a few things that you put out in your book that to me indicate this exact thing.
Yeah, it's what I've found, and no doubt right now I can track precisely back to 3114 BC. I've got that. There's no doubt about that. I can even get to the 10,500 BC date that Robert Bouval discusses, and it even goes back further than that. I can go back 25,920 years from the year zero, which is interesting. And I'm still trying to get my head around some of that because that's way too much of a coincidence. And then again, putting in the year zero in the Gregorian calendar, it's all kind of tied together. But right now, I'm very confident that things have been pretty stable in the sky since 3114 BC because these alignments that I've discovered, they're so precise, you won't believe it, that couldn't possibly be the case if anything had changed.
That's exactly what I mean because, when I've heard the theory that, we had a 360-day solar year and then all of a sudden it got changed to 365, day or whatever because something got knocked out of place. But to me, none of that makes any sense. And the reason that I'm bringing this up is that this was something that I was actually writing about in my own book and then I see it's in your book as well, is that when we look at it's not Khafre, it's Menkaure, right? This is one of the Great Pyramids.
Yeah.
One of the sides is 343 feet.
Yes.
And you say in the book, well, 7 cubed is 343. And we could talk about 7 cubed or the number 7 all day long and the mm-hmm. importance of it in mythology. 7 plus 7 plus 7 equals 21. So right. This gives you 343 plus 21 being 364. And, of course, the 364-day calendar is the calendar that we find in Chichen Itza, the Pyramid of Kukulcan. Mm-hmm. We find it in the deck of cards. This is the question. Is like, how is it that a solar calendar, down to the precision of within a day, is found by the simply playing with the number 7? You know what I mean? If there was a 360-day year, and if things weren't stable, if things weren't fixed, then how could such an occurrence happen, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I've been having discussions with Layard about this. He wrote a little bit on the calendars and the Velikovsky heresies, and this 360-day calendar. Well, here's what I've come to find, not necessarily in the solar, but it would apply to the solar thing as well. Think of this, okay? We have a spiral. At the center of that spiral, where the two diagonals would cross within your golden rectangle, mm-hmm. there would be the center. It's actually, it would be an imaginary point at the center of that spiral. If you were to index a 360-degree circle on that, so that when you measured the spiral would actually go around in 360 degrees, but it would not be following a circular path. Okay? So if we were to measure, we could say, oh, we're going to measure around this spiral, and we're going to measure around 360 divisions, or days, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. But the actual travel, because we're not going in a circle, if we were traveling in a spiral motion or helical motion, we would have to adjust because we're moving forward, okay? This wouldn't be a stationary spiral. It would be a spiral as we're moving forward. The sun is moving through space at, a pretty high rate of speed. So, therefore, we aren't necessarily just making a circle around the sun. We're kind of going around in a forward motion. So when you add the length of the additional path around that, if you measured the circumference of each part of that radius of the spiral, you would come to a slightly different measurement. Did you get that PowerPoint I sent to you about the 23.5 degrees tilt of the Earth and the 259.2 degrees?
Yes, I did. Yep.
Okay, go back on your own here and you could check that out, and you'll see exactly what I mean. So, what I'm thinking is that when they talk about the 360-day year, I'm thinking that it's very possible that they're talking about just dividing it in 360 degrees. But the actual measure, when we actually go around that, because we're not going in a circle and we're moving ahead in a spiral or helical motion, that time that it would take would be a little longer because we're traversing a little longer path, not a perfectly circular one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that could account for the extra few days that would be in a year. Now, I don't know, you know, I'm not an astrophysicist, and I don't claim to be, but I did find that to be the case of how they encoded these spirals at Giza. And the Wall of the Crow and the Temple of Khentkawis, I guess is how you pronounce it, those two structures at Giza point that out precisely, that they're pointing to the difference in the length around a spiral and the distance around the circumference of the circle. They're pointing to those two things. So I think that's something that we need to look at least consider and do some calculations based on, you know, what I found. I think we could answer that question.
You know, philosophically, and this whole concept makes a lot of sense to me, because it's the idea that it's almost like there's sort of like perfect geometry put into movement, and then it sort of like throws that perfect geometry a little bit off, and that's what we end up with, you know, like, for instance, 360 not being 360 days in a solar year, 365. The ellipse, it seems like the ellipse is just off a perfect circle, right?
Right.
So it's almost right. It's almost as if a creator or whatever put this stuff as a template, put it into movement, and that's why we don't see a perfect circle in an elliptical. We have an elliptical orbit and not a perfect circular orbit, because right. It's almost like that circle is being smushed because it's moving through space. So right. Philosophically and conceptually, that makes sense, and it would be really in tune with what you're saying about the Fibonacci, the golden rectangle.
Yeah, and I really would like to get some people together on this. I did contact Walter Cruttenden. I'd like to speak with him a little bit more about this. He does have the facilities there where we could really map this out. Mm-hmm. I've actually too contacted the local university here, and they have a planetarium. I'm hoping to be able to meet with those folks and go in there and let's physically map out what I've got here. I think we could figure out a few things here. I think precession is going to be a very interesting thing here with looking at what I found.
It seems that this mapping of this great span of time is key to a lot of these mysteries when it really comes down to it, right?
Yes, absolutely. You yeah. bet. That's the big story there. I mean, I think they're... Look here, folks. Here's the knowledge you're going to need, because when these catastrophes happen, you need to know this.
So we only got like a few minutes here, but where, you know, since we're pointing to this day 2012, this grand alignment that we see with the center of our galaxy, where do you think that we're at in the cycle? I mean, do you subscribe to a blooming of consciousness, a reawakening of spirit, or any of that? Or what's your take on that?
You know, I really, I've got an open mind to all that. I really don't know for sure. But, you know, I continue to just do the research here and see what happens. I don't know. I mean, there's very good possibility that could happen. And I really think that just understanding what is at Giza will change our consciousness.
I mean, it seems that that's what it's doing right now for all yeah. of these independent researchers. I mean, myself included, obviously yourself,
absolutely.
Yeah. You know, yeah. As you explained earlier. So, I mean, to me, it's like, okay, well, that, it just makes sense that these ancient people put that there to sort of, prod people about the mystery of existence and about these grand mysteries, so that we would actually rediscover these things.
That's right. And I do believe, yeah, I mean, this will change people's thinking, consciousness, when they realize the simplicity and beauty of, you know, this creation and this magnificent place we're living, you know?
Yeah. I mean, geez, there's so much more I wanted to cover. I wanted to talk about the root qubit and the royal qubit and how you found that. So, but we're probably going to have to make that for another time. So
let's do it again, Maury. I would love to. Talking to you. And I wanted to tell you too, just a quick note. You know, I did check some of your alphabet with these names and stuff at Giza, and it's amazing. We could hope we could have a night on that. You know.
Yeah, the one that just floored me was, you know, the upper angle of the missing capstone of the Great Pyramid is roughly 76 degrees. Yeah. And Isis, Osiris, and Horus, if you do the numerology of that, the gematria of that, it equals 76.
Yeah.
So we're just things like that.
There's so many things I'd like to talk to you about.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? It's like, you know, that, you know, when as you've gone through this investigation, when you come up with these little connections and these little sparks, they aliven the spirit, do they not?
Oh, absolutely. I can't tell you, it's transformed my life, really, understanding, you know, what I've found. It's just amazing.
Yeah. So okay, so you're working on your follow-up book. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, what that's going to be called and when that's due?
Yeah, I'm hoping to have it done in a couple of months. I've got basically all the graphics done and all the research done behind it. Now I just got to assemble it and kind of write it out. But it essentially takes it from the Sphinx. The first book has basically the placement of all 11 pyramids and the Sphinx. Now the Sphinx is basically the witness, that the mark, the witness mark where you're measuring the heavens and measuring the sky and the movement, the trajectory of the solar system and the, you know, the celestial bodies. So what I've done there is just from that point at the Sphinx, have gone through and using the Stellarium software, mapped out in the sky, especially Orion and Leo and Sirius and the Pleiades, those being the major point of focus here. And I'll step through that just like I stepped through the other part of the book. And actually, you know, someone with this Stellarium can do it and look at it just as they're going through the book and see how it's really quite easy. And you know, I'm just going to reconcile the calendars and show you precisely what the job of the Sphinx was, and that is to mark time. You know, he's the keeper of time, the measure of the ages.
Yeah, and the watcher of the heavens. Yeah.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah,
that was its chore.
So, how do people pick up your new book? It's available on Amazon, right? Do you have a website?
Amazon, yes, and I have a website. It's thegizatemplate.com. You can check that out. And again, it's a self-published book, so it's basically through Amazon right now. That could change at some point, but for now, that's where you can find it. And like I said, within a couple of months, I should have this next part available, and look forward to that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, Ed, thanks for coming on, man. It's been really great. Best of luck to you, and yeah, let's do this again. When you get the new book out, maybe we can do something for the web to get some visuals for the listeners, because that's always helpful with this sort of thing. So,
absolutely, I've really enjoyed our talk and love to do it again, Marty.
All right, thanks, man. Best to you.
Thanks. Right. You too.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Our outro song is called Holding Smoke and is provided by Eugene, Oregon's very own Michael Conley. The last time I saw this guy play live, my friend Ryan and I had one too many beers and ended up having one too many more because this guy was just killing it. He was just captivating the room. I've been listening to this song at work every day since I heard it and downloaded it. And this track is the title track to Michael's latest record, which can be purchased at iTunes as well as on his site, michaelconley.info, and Conley is spelled C-O-N-L-E-Y. Coming up in the next few episodes of the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour will be host of the Crow House, Max Egan, producer and writer of The Pyramid Code, Dr. Carmen Bolter, and I am working at getting some of the contributors for the up-and-coming Modern Knowledge Tour. Make sure to stay tuned and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
his land. He broke the earth with his own two hands. And when we laid him beneath the yoke, we outlined his grave in stone. My father built this old house, drove every nail by himself. And when we lost it to the fire, well, I cried, I felt like he was still inside. Oh, what's the point of holding on if it all just slips away, away, like holding smoke in your lungs? All the remnants of a day. Days just keeps to herself. The doctors are worried about her health. She's getting closer with every cigarette. I know she just wants to lay with him. My brothers, they don't seem to care. Dan's drive a truck and Paul's in Delaware. They both got lives of their own, and they doubt they'll even make it home. And what's the point of holding on if it all just slips away, away, like holding smoke in your lungs? All the remnants of a day. She passed before the holidays. My brothers came, but they didn't stay. They left me alone in this old house, and I plan to rebuild it by myself. Oh, what's the point of holding on if it all just slips away, away, like holding smoke in your lungs? All the remnants of a day. And what's the point of holding on if it all just slips away, away, like holding smoke of a day?
Been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathmagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com, and be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.